This is the I Read Comic Books podcast. I'm Mike Rappin, editor-in-chief for Destroy the Cyborg, and this week I am joined by one host, Nick White, comic book staff writer. Thank you for joining me this week, Nick. How are comic books for you?
Comic books are pretty good. I've actually been making some major headway and getting through some of my back issues, and things are pretty excellent. I still need to read Batman 40, but all things in good time. That being said, a spoiler alert, by the time I get around to it, I expect Bruce Wayne to be up and walking again. So how about you?
Comics have been great. They're always great. I actually managed to catch up. Like, last week was a really big week for me, both like in physical and digital like books, and I managed to catch up with about like all of the new comics that I had. I feel like I had all the new comics and from this past week and the week before I caught up on, and now it's just kind of like a handful of books that I've been like sitting on waiting to read, like Imperium and stuff like that. But I've got to catch up on a couple other books before I even get to that. So I haven't read Divinity yet either. So that's like my Oof. Little like cherry on top for when I finish all of Harbinger and all of that stuff and get caught up with everything that's going on in the Valiant Universe. So
it's been good. I'm telling you, you can read Divinity all by its lonesome. You know?
Yeah. I'm just
worried by the time you get around to it, they're going to roll the trade out, so...
Well, yeah, it's almost done. I know I own all the issues. Like, I've been buying the issues every month. It's just that, like, I'm sitting on it, like, waiting for that moment when I finally catch up with Harbinger and say that, you know, Mike, you actually did this. But which means I also have to read Bloodshot, which means whatever. So it's basically me forcing myself to read all the Valiant books that I've been putting off for a long time.
I'll send you a flow chart.
Perfect. So, you know, speaking of comic books, let's talk about our comic book picks for this week. Nick, your pick is Ninjak number 3, speaking of Valiant. What's going on with this book?
Well, what's going on with this book is that we are now sort of seeing this book hit its stride. And Ninjak, or gosh, his real name is Colin. I think it's Colin Cross. Maybe I'm wrong. Man, I know it's Colin. Regardless,
it doesn't sound like a ninja name.
It doesn't sound like a ninja name. It really isn't. But you know, you get what you're given. It's sort of reaching a point where you're getting to see him plan his missions and operations, and it's much more about like stealth and obviously, and it's about planning. You know, I knew that when he served the wine that night, he would probably serve this bottle because it was perfect for this equation. So you get like that Batman of where it's just layers of planning on planning on planning on planning, and it's enjoyable actually.
Oh, absolutely. Well, like stories like that are always really cool when you realize like, oh man, our guy's got it all figured out, and then something happens. You go, oh no, he doesn't, and then it turns out he did. Like it's Ocean's 11. Like why do we love Ocean's 11?
Exactly. And what's funny is he thinks he's got it completely figured out, and for the most part he does, except then someone pushes him or basically knocks him out of a high-rise window, and the last page is him just falling out of this you know, really, 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 really high up window of this like skyscraper or whatever, and it's like, uh-oh. But it's such a great way to leave, you know, such a great way to wrap an issue, and you're like, oh geez, you know, literal cliffhanger of sorts. So but it's enjoyable. I really like that it's a 40-page issue, and for the foreseeable future, it will continue to be. And I do like that it's got a backstory in it. So
wow, that's 40 pages every week. That's
yeah.
Is it $3.99 then?
It is.
Okay.
It is.
Well, you know what? That justifies the $3.99 price tag.
Oh, it totally does. But I mean, most other non DC publishers are $3.99 for whatever they're going to give you with however many ads and whatnot. So this mm-hmm. is it's a real deal, and I think it's really interesting because the backstory is sort of about his earlier days as an agent. So you see some of his earlier missions, and you see him interacting with his handler. And I'm waiting. I'm just waiting for like that handler from the older stories to come into the fore on the main one. So, you know, one of those things where it's like these characters will prove relevant eventually.
Right. Right.
So, cool, yeah, man. Great book. What about you?
So yeah, this week I picked another Warren Ellis book because I can't not pick Warren Ellis books, I guess. This week
That's
is
fine.
Trees number 9, which is you know, it's a middle middle issue, like, you know, in the middle of a series. It's not a fancy number three or something. I don't know. I feel like we always aim towards like earlier books, but nonetheless, Trees number nine is the series coming back after a short hiatus. They basically wrote the first 8 issues of Trees, Warren Ellis and Jason Howard on art. They did the first 8 issues, which is supposed to be like a contained story, and now with Trees number 9, we're seeing Trees Book 2 is what Ellis calls it, or what they're calling it online, at least in the solicits. So this is like the second story in probably a 3-arc story all about what's happening with this Trees universe. Like, and I cannot express to you enough, like, this book is so cool in terms of like kind of being all over the place and telling bits and pieces of the story. And it reminds me of, I guess, what I've been told, the zombie book that Max Brooks wrote, where it's kind of like little pieces of this story as it goes on. And that's what Trees has felt like to me, just like little excerpts of what's happening in the world with these giant alien tree structure things that are just planted on Earth. And I mean, it's such a bizarre, out there book. I really enjoyed it. It's not like bizarre in like the setting, not so much as like the story. Like we were talking about like Injection last week, which was kind of out there in like Warren Ellis's weird way. Whereas Trees is a little bit more of a straightforward story. And this book is really cool. And I wouldn't have picked another Ellis book if I had other choices. I mean, it was a close tie between or competition between The Fade Out and Trees this week. But Trees, definitely, I'm way more excited about it coming back because I really want and explore this weird parallels, like this weird Earth that Ellis has created with these alien structures. And so it's going to be great. I know it's going to be fun. And Jason Howard's art is always like on point. Like the dude, I've followed this guy since he was doing like Super Dinosaur way back with, or Astounding Wolfman way back with Robert Kirkman. Like I've been reading everything that he's done, and like you can definitely see an evolved like artist going from Astounding Wolfman all the way to now. And he's definitely gotten more experimental with the way that he does things, and getting away from like doing shading. I mean, I guess that's probably because Super Dinosaur and Astounding Wolfman were kind of like bright superhero comics, and something like this and Trees and the Scatterlands webcomic that he did with Warren Ellis as well, like are definitely darker and like more like out there in terms of like him trying out different things with his style. And this book like totally kills it. It's so cool. Like he has a perfect art style for the weird mechanical, biological things that this Trees series does or has in it. Like I highly suggest it. Especially, I think you can get volume 1 of Trees, which is 8 issues for $10 from Image.
Oh, I've like, got it.
That's such an amazing deal. You should. Everyone should go out there and buy it and try it. It's a really cool sci-fi story. We don't get a lot of sci-fi stories like this that don't have, like, there's personal narratives in the story, but that's not what the story's about. I feel like we don't get a lot of sci-fi like that nowadays, and this is one of those books that's about the setting and what's actually happening outside of the characters. And the characters, you realize, are just these very small pieces of the story that add to this much larger, like, aspect of what's happening with these weird alien things that are called the Trees. So, I could go on and on about this book, but it's a great read, and I'm really excited that it's back this week.
Totally. It sounds a lot like his, what was that other series he did? The one about sort of like that agency, that government agency with all these different experts
around the world.
Global Frequency. Yeah, it just feels like just sort of juggling all these different narratives and just sort of, he's very comfortable with that, really.
Absolutely.
And sort of not having to have a singular character-centric book. I mean, that's not really Ellis's thing for the most part.
Yeah, I think he does like single character books really well. When he does these anthology style stories, or like stories that are told in multiple parts from like perspectives of people that don't relate at all, I think that's where like a lot of writers can like either they shine or they completely just strike out and they can't do it very well. And Ellis has found this good balancing point, I think, with this series, whereas everything else that he's writing right now is kind of focused around, you know, single or small teams of people. This one is definitely more out there in terms of, like, multiple narratives happening in parallel and not crossing over at all. So, hence what parallel means, you know.
Yeah, totally. No. So it's good to know.
Well, cool. So,
I'm glad you're enjoying it.
I definitely am. But we're going to take a quick break, you know, just as just the Nick and I, and we're going to come back in a moment with our news gloss over, which we're still working on, and we hope that you enjoy it. But we'll be back in just a quick second.
everybody, it's time for that weekly feature that we call the news gloss over until its name changes again, or until we reformat it. But you know what? It's a work in progress, and I'd like to think that it's a good work in progress. Obviously, progress does not indicate a positive motion of things, but we'd like to think that ours has it. So that being said, the first item on our docket to discuss, Mike, do you read any of DC's digital first books, or do you even know what this is?
I don't read any DC digital first books. That's because I don't read any DC anymore, Nick. After Swamp Thing ended, I have no DC books.
That was it.
My pull list. But I'm aware of this. I mean, like, I'm pretty regular on Comixology's website, so I mean, I see these digital firsts every week, and I've seen like Batman 66, and I think there was like one or two others. I think you're more familiar with that, though, right?
Yeah, I mean, the main reason I asked whether you were familiar with it or not is because DC, when the New 52 rolled out, they were making a real effort to try this model, just like they were making a real effort to try selling comics digitally. And right. It just seems like DC readers just aren't taking to this. And so they've slowly backed off a lot of their models, and they canceled a bunch of their digital first books, Legends of the Dark Knight. I think Adventures of Superman is done, Amakami Girls. A few have done really well. Adventures of Superman has reviewed amazingly well, even if it didn't always sell great. And Batman 66, holy cow, that book is selling really, really well. But that being said, despite them not really doing great in that model, they are actually starting a new book that's just going to be called DC Comics Bombshells. And if you're thinking, well, what the heck is that based upon? It's, if you're not familiar with what that is, it's based upon two things: a series of figurines that DC has rolled out, and a series of variant covers that they had in what would have been June of 2014. And that is the entire basis for this.
So, just to go back a second, Wonder Woman 77, isn't that a digital first book as well? Didn't that just recently come out?
Yes, that's correct. Okay. That one is pretty brand spanking new. Yeah. If it even has started. Has it started?
I'm not 100% sure. I feel like number one is out because I read some advance reviews, but I know that people were, like, it's reviewing really well. People are saying that, like, if you liked Wonder Woman from the 70s, you're going to love this comic book. Just, you know, the same way that Batman 66 appeals to all those people that love the old Batman shows. So, nonetheless, but to go, this specific book, DC's Bombshells, so this is strictly based off of the pinup covers and, like, action figures, right? There's no... Like, I don't know, does that have, being someone that's probably more familiar with DC than me, like, does that have any basis in the comic world at all? Is there like a multiversity universe where everyone's a pinup character or something?
Man,
should they
put
Grant Morrison on this book?
And you know what? If you were to call up Grant Morrison, I think not all of the worlds of the multiverse were explicitly addressed, so maybe there is one, or maybe he needs to have one. But I'm sure if you told Grant Morrison that he needed to set up a universe based on a series of figurines, that would go over real well. It's too establishment,
man. So
what's the
news here with this book? Is it just like the fact that it's being announced, or just like, I mean, because it seems kind of, I don't know, like, are those pinup covers like super popular? Is it like, I don't know, like, are fans screaming about this?
I really enjoyed the variant covers. I thought they were pretty great, but if you would have asked me if I would have thought that they were ever going to start a book based on this, I would have said that's ridiculous, except, of course, they've done this before. They did Amakami Girls, which was their anime sort of series of figurines. I don't know if you remember this.
I remember it coming out.
They based an entire, I think, digital first series on that, and that went from September of 2012 to March of 2013, so they've based books on less before.
Gotcha.
And it looks really fun, though. I think the art's great. I do like the team. They're proudly boasting that both it's a pair of Marguerites that are both writing and drawing the book.
That's cool.
So you've got Marguerite Bennett writing it, and recently she has had some success as she's the co-writer of A-Force. Mm-hmm. She's also done some other books for DC within the Batverse. And you've got Marguerite Sauvage, unless I've butchered it. Although Bleeding Cool misspelled it and said her name's Marguerite Savage. So Bleeding Cool,
nice.
you might want to check yourself before you wreck your spelling or something. But yeah, I really like the team. It's going to be, we don't really know much else other than that. It's going to focus on, this is literally all I've got, DC superheroines during World War II.
Okay.
That's what I've got.
Okay.
That's what I've got for you right now.
Well, you know, I mean, DC seems to be stretching that period piece thing a lot, and I think that works well for them. You know, like Batman 66, Wonder Woman 77, like this is like Pinup Girls 44 or something, like I don't know. I mean, like, that's interesting that, I mean, they're trying something that's kind of out of the box, like, to try to, like, you know, we've talked about this, like, Elseworlds, Otherworlds stuff that people really enjoy, and I think this is another example of that. People might really enjoy this simply because it's like, oh, look, your favorite superheroes, but with a twist, and that's, you know, something we all, you know, buy into at some point. So, that'll be cool to see. I mean,
yeah.
I'd be interested to actually read the first issue, if anything, you know?
Totally, and I think a lot of us are always really, we're always really, really interested when a character or a group of characters that are usually so heavily embedded in canon, just like Batman characters or Superman characters, where it's like, oh no, but when all of a sudden these characters are thrown into a book where it's like, you don't have to read anything before this, or this has nothing to do with mainstream canon. That stuff's appealing. So I'll probably when it gets rolled into a print issue, I'll likely take a look at that.
Cool.
If they choose to do that. So.
Cool, man. Well, yeah, just moving on. I think, you know, the first thing I had was a small announcement. They are more or less solidified on the casting of Spider-Man, or at least like the heavy rumor mongers out there are like pretty much saying that they can confirm that Asa Butterfield is going to be playing the new Spider-Man, like the new young 15-16-year-old Spider-Man. And if you look at Asa Butterfield, for anyone who's listening and probably wants to look this person up, he is a younger kid. He played Ender in the Ender's Game movie that came out. He was also in
he was Hugo in the Hugo movie.
Yes, thank
so
you.
So he only takes part in movies where he can play the character that the movie's named after. So,
yeah.
so Spider-Man will work. Spider-Man will work just fine.
And I mean, if you look at this kid, I think he's a good fit in terms of like, he's supposed to be a small, scrawny little nerd, and you know, that's Spider-Man. You know, like this kid kind of, in my mind, I guess, fits the young, fresh Spider-Man. Like, especially if you think of like Brian Michael Bendis' take on Spider-Man and Ultimate Spider-Man way back in, what was it, 2001 or something like that. That character was supposed to be like this young little scrawny kid, and this is exactly who Asa Butterfield is. So it's interesting to see how this is going to play out, especially if he's confirmed. I don't know, Nick, what do you think about this?
Well, you know, first off, I'm a little torn because here we go again. Here's another British kid playing an American superhero for the umpteenth time. Here we go. No, I'm kidding. I'm not bent out of shape, but it is an interesting coincidence that it's happening again. Otherwise, I think he is very... I think he's a great character, you know, a kid actor. I haven't seen Ender's Game. I did think he was great in Hugo.
Ender's Game, you could probably skip Ender's Game. I'll say that.
Yeah. Uh-oh, I don't know how Xander's going to feel about that. I don't know if he liked the movie or not. I know he loves
this is all
book.
Just going to be a big bleep. He's just, you know what, Mike? Blasphemy, you know? No, anyways.
Yeah, exactly. It's just going to get cut out completely. No, I think it's a good choice. I think he looks the part. I think a lot of times when you're casting younger, I think, at least from what I've been told, there's more of a temptation to go with look over actual talent. And I think this kid actually has the chops. I know they were looking at the kid who played... have you seen The Killing?
I haven't.
Okay. The kid who plays the female detective's son. They were looking at him for it for a bit. But I think Asa Butterfield is definitely a higher profile name, and I think he's a bit of a rising star. So yeah, I'm totally okay with that. The only problem they're gonna have is when they tell him that the movie is gonna be called Captain America 3, and then at that point he's gonna tell you he's out because he doesn't play that way.
He'll have to renegotiate his contract so he can. It'll say Spider-Man in parentheses and Captain America 3:
Rise of the Spider-Man or something.
Yeah, something like that.
See, the next thing I was going to talk about or bring up was the fact that in terms of the top-selling comics for April of 2015, there's a very, 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 very interesting, I guess you could say it's actually an absence. There is not one Marvel superhero book in the top 10 bestsellers.
That...
Which has got to be the first time in, like, forever. Ever.
Oh yeah, and but at the same time, I mean, but there are Marvel books in the top 10 list, right?
Yes, that is true. And okay. and you're right to point out that qualifying statement on my end. Yeah, it's weird because obviously Marvel is usually just knocking DC all over the place. DC usually finds one book on the list, but yeah, the list is quite simply made up of 4 Star Wars books. You've got 5 Convergence books, which is DC's event that's going on right now. And you've got Batman 40, which isn't surprising considering that all of the speculators are trying to find that now, and they didn't ship enough, apparently. So
wow. I think this, you know, this begs the question, and I think you mentioned this in the pre-show about, like, is this Star Wars thing actually a thing now? Like, we were super speculative about it. Like, we were, I was like, yeah, the number one's going to sell a shitload, and after that, it's gonna taper off. But, like, I think this proves that not only Star Wars is doing well, but all of the other Star Wars books are doing incredibly well. Like, I knew Princess Leia was doing well, but what else is on the list?
Star Wars, just a book with the name Star Wars, was the number one spot. Darth Vader was number 5. And then, oh, gosh. I think it was...
I think Princess Leia was on there, yeah.
Yeah, I don't have it written here which one is which, but Canon or whatever, the last Padawan, him and Princess Leia were down near the bottom in the 8 and 10 slots, but
yeah.
It's a great question. I remember, you know, obviously Star Wars number 1 sold a bunch and everyone went, well, it's Star Wars and it's nostalgia, and they said, plus loot crate artificially, you know,
yeah.
Are you quoting altered me? Altered the numbers.
Because I think you're quoting me. Anyways.
Yeah. No, well, I mean, you're right. I mean, the numbers were huge, and then everyone said, let's see how issue number 2 sells. Ha, 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 ha.
Yeah.
And I think it still sold, I think, 250K.
Something around there.
Which is still phenomenal. I mean, I think people that don't understand how comic book numbers operate looked at that and said, well, see what I mean? It's a failure. That's like, right, you know, yeah, what's, right, you know, 75% drop off. Yuck, yuck, yuck. I mean, I could be wrong on this, but I think Batman sells somewhere between like 50 and 60,000 every month.
Yeah, you're right.
So Star Wars selling 250, and I have to believe maybe by issue 4, maybe that number is, I don't want to rampantly speculate, but even if that number is half, even if by issue 4 we're down to like 125 or something, that's still amazing.
Yeah, that's still incredibly significant.
That's like, still beating the pants off of every single book out there, you know?
Right.
And, yeah, it begs the question, like, how much longer before we say this is, like, the real deal? Do we have to wait and see when the movie comes out, or wait and see when it maybe hits, like, the 10 or 15-issue threshold? And furthermore, what is that, like, how does that maybe change Marvel's marketing plans? I guess the biggest question I would have for you would be, did Marvel just have a weak month? Like, is this an unusually just bad month for Marvel to begin with?
Well, I think April is kind of an anomaly. I don't doubt that these numbers for Star Wars books are, like, off in any way, but I do think that a lot of Marvel books were ending or had ended recently, so there was kind of like an opening. Like, there was like this, there was no new number ones in April because Marvel was basically shutting everything down to lead into Secret Wars. So, you know, I think a lot of titles ended that month, and I don't think there was anything to replace those titles. So we didn't see the resurgence of like new number ones that take up the, you know, the space of selling points for books that were ending. Because, you know, like if one of your books is ending this month and a new number one's coming out in parallel, you might as well pick up both of those books because now you're ending something and starting something new. So maybe people either didn't buy any new Marvel stuff, or they were like basically saving their pennies to buy, you know, that $5 Secret Wars number one that came out this month. So I think we were in a weird spot for Marvel, but nonetheless, I don't think that like we should write off like canon or whatever you want to call it. Like that was a new number one that month. I think that was one of Marvel's only number ones that month, outside of maybe something they might have done in like their Icon imprint or something. But I think Kanan basically probably took up the place of, you know, anything that people may have lost because of cancellations or because of Secret Wars in March and early April. So, that doesn't surprise me too much. But yeah, it's kind of a weird month, but at the same time, I still think Star Wars being number one at number four, you know, Star Wars number four at the number one most sold comic is like proof that the Star Wars thing, I don't think, is dying out, at least not yet, you know?
Yeah, and it'll be real interesting to see when the artist change happens, whether or not that'll rattle anybody loose. I don't know. I think that's set for like 6 or 7.
Probably at the end of this arc or beginning of next arc, I should say.
Yeah, and that's when... Oh, geez, who's currently doing the art on that? Kicking myself over this.
I don't know.
Well, I don't remember who it is, but I know he's being swapped out for Immonen. For Stuart Immonen for Arc 2, so...
Cool.
At least in my mind, I think that might be an improvement.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I guess the biggest question is, like, what do you think for next month? Convergence wraps up and all of those titles get removed off the list. Do you think Secret Wars is just going to basically just jam the whole thing shut and, you know, probably flood the whole...
Oh, yeah.
Probably do the exact same things Convergence is doing.
Oh, yeah. Yep. I not too pleased about it, but it's happening. Nothing I can do about it. So, you know, but anyways, so, that's interesting though. That's good. That's good to talk about, but, just moving on, the last thing I wanted to bring up, this is kind of a smaller thing, but I think it leads into a bigger discussion about television. Constantine was rumored to be moving over to CW, and apparently CW's CEO or person, whoever would be in charge, said, don't get your hopes up, which is interesting because, I mean, the fact that that was even, like, rumored says that, like, CW is pretty much the only network that's really trying to take a chance at these superhero shows and is doing them in such a way that they're selling well. I mean, obviously Flash and Arrow and then the upcoming Legends of Tomorrow. Those are all, you know, the two shows that already exist are obviously doing very, very well. And people want more, which is why Legends of Tomorrow is coming out. And I saw that trailer this week because that came out this week too, as well as the Supergirl trailer, which we're going to talk about later. But that show looks like super bizarro. And it's like the thing that I think CW needs. But like the fact that they have all of these TV shows that are like superhero based, and if Supergirl is somehow wrapped in into their continuity, that's three shows that could potentially have, you know, be all in the same contained universe, or four shows I should say, and then iZombie on as well, you know, on the network. So I know I took all of your talking points, Nick. So what Jeez. Do you think about this?
Well. No, it's kind of funny because, and you didn't take this one. No, I'm just kidding. Stephen Amell, in the day or two before the cancellation was official, well, NBC's cancellation was official anyway. Yeah. He said that if the show was saved, that he would do a cameo appearance on the show. To which all NBC executives said, "Who the hell is Stephen Amell?" I'm just kidding. It was kind of a fun gesture. I'm sure he's like, I know I won't have to deliver on this, which is too bad because I would have loved to see that happen. But yeah, it's you're totally right. If there's anywhere that this show would have seemingly ended up, it would have been the CW, and it sort of reflects this just new idea we've seen in the last year or two that shows just don't go away. Like, cancellation is not the end anymore. Like,
right.
Fans right. are finding new ways to keep shows alive.
Yeah, I totally agree there. I think, like, you could even go back to, like, And I looked this up because we were, you know, we were talking about this in the pre-show. But like, you know, shows like Jericho way back in early 2000s that was getting canceled. People mailed, you know, to reach out. Like the internet wasn't so, you know, so, I guess, big in terms of like critical output, and it wasn't so respected because there wasn't a lot of, there wasn't Facebook or Twitter. So people rallied together and sent peanuts to CBS to say, hey, we want to keep Jericho on the air. And apparently there's some tie into the show where a character says "on nuts" or says "nuts" or something like that when he gets captured. And so as part of the joke, they sent a bunch of peanuts to CBS, and that show came back and I think lasted like another two seasons or something like that. And I mean, like, that's not the only show that that's happened. You know, fan outcry can keep shows alive in some case. In some cases, like, you know, I think Twin Peaks is another example. Obviously, people rallied behind trying to get Firefly back and still are trying to get Firefly back, even though Joss Whedon and the rest of the cast have moved on with their lives. So it's like, it's curious. It had me, you know, wondering, you know, where are these networks getting these numbers that say they should cancel a show when, like, obviously, if there's a big fan base to these shows, like, why are they canceling them? Like, if people are dedicated and are going to sell them, you know, and want to watch them and actively participate in you know, how they're made and what's happening, like, why are they canceling these shows? Like, is it a numbers thing? Is it a, we don't like this producer? Is it, I mean, in some cases, you know, like, if a creator leaves and there's no heart behind the show anymore, then they can't go on. But on the other hand, like, I feel like a lot of the times these shows get canceled because of numbers. And it's strange to see, like, a show get canceled and have all the fans go, well, this is a bunch of bullshit. And it's not just, like, 10 or 12 people. It's, like, a million or 2 or 3 million people. Like, what's the threshold to keep a show on the air?
Totally. And I think probably one of the problems is that and having an ardent fan base, a vocal fan base, having people willing to mail things in or call people's offices, unfortunately, it would appear that that doesn't always translate to the numbers game. I mean, we can talk about the umpteen bajillion people that watch NCIS or NCIS. what are the other ones now? Like Cyber, and the other one is like
Los Angeles. I don't even know.
Deep South. I think it's like in Louisiana. Yeah, in New Orleans, I think. Anyway, why are we wasting our time trying to come up with that? Anyway, and we look at those numbers, and like, these numbers are huge, but like, these aren't the sorts of shows that like the people that watch it every week in and week out, like, they're not gonna go, like, they're not gonna go to bat for this show. They're not gonna write things. They're not gonna call people. A lot of the people that watch NCIS probably struggle updating Internet Explorer to a point that they can get on there and, yeah, and voice their concerns. So, oh snap. The only reason I feel comfortable making that joke is that I know that those very same people are not the people that are going to figure out how to listen to this podcast. So,
so sweeping generalizations aside, what's your point, Nick?
Sweeping generalizations about the aged population of America and how they love CBS. Yeah, it's like I said, it really boils down to the fact that unfortunately sometimes there are programs that just incite this like huge amount of love and devotion from fans, but if you don't have the numbers, you're gonna get canned. Or you gotta win awards. You gotta win awards. Like Fox was ready to kill Brooklyn Nine-Nine, and then it won Best Comedy and it won Best Comedic Actor, and they went, well, shit.
Yeah, you can't really cancel a show that's got a bunch of like notoriety to it.
Yeah, same thing happened with Arrested Development. That thing was on the chopping block, and then mm-hmm. Bateman won Best Actor, and the show won Best Comedy, and Fox was like thwarted again.
Yeah. So, I mean, and of course, then there's the alternative of moving a show to another network, like, or specifically online. Like, Netflix has been buying up canceled shows left and right, you know, Arrested Development totally. Being one of those shows. So it's interesting, like,
Arrested
to see,
being
you know,
one, Killing being another.
Yeah. And, like, CW even potentially thinking of the idea of buying a show or getting a show from NBC is, like, monumental in my head. Like, I don't think we'd ever see, like, a show change hands through networks like that, or we haven't seen that in a long time. And the fact that that's happening simply because, like, what if Constantine moved to Hulu or Yahoo Screen or something like that, you know? Who's to say that, like, that's not an option? So it's just interesting to think that like that idea even could potentially exist, because I think now network TV is trying to compete with Netflix and compete with all these other places that are buying up these shows that have massive fan bases. And then when the shows do well, it's like, shit, NBC lost a bunch of money on The Killing, you know, because of its popularity on Netflix, you know. They lost ad money at least.
Right, and I think that's sort of what's kind of setting the scene for what we're seeing when these shows are revived, is that nobody wants to accidentally hand it over to someone else who could really wield some damage with it. Like, I mean, The Killing went to Netflix, but it only got a 6-episode season. You know, Community went to Yahoo, but it's a digital series, and yeah, the production values are high, but they're not what they were.
Right. Right.
Or in the same vein, sure. The Mindy Project is going off Fox and it's going to Hulu, but, who knows? I bet you're probably going to see the cast of that show get scaled down a bit, or something's going to happen, mm-hmm. To make it more, budget friendly. And that in turn really begs the question of sometimes, if we really, really love a show, do we want to see it continue on in a method that might not be exactly what we had before? You know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, yeah, having that scaled down cast or scaled down effects or just even production quality in general, like, I think it's a very tough thing to balance, because like fans really want this, but if the show doesn't live up to what it potentially could have been, then like what was the point of continuing? And I think that like people like Netflix and Hulu struggle with that, and saying, you know, we want to produce this show, we can't produce it at the same level that it was, so what can we do to adjust things to, you know, change it so that it can be done in a decent enough way. And I think at the end of the day, like a lot of the times, like these fan bases, these rabid, loud fan bases, like they just want more of the show. And even if production quality is a little lower, you know, they can deal with it. Like I think that like diehard fans of Constantine could take a tone down on special effects in order to get a cool fucking Constantine story. And Constantine's not even about flashy magic in the first place. So like,
yeah,
that's the interesting thing. Like if it moved to a network that didn't have the funds to, you know, pay for all this crazy CGI fire, like, maybe that's okay. Maybe the story goes in a more detective, like magical detective direction, like it should have been in the first place. So who knows?
Yeah, it's a good question. I personally, I think my biggest problem is that I just don't like Constantine.
Yeah.
End of story.
Yeah. I mean, I only watched the first episode, so whatever.
I made it through two.
Yeah. Cool. Well, we're gonna take a quick break. When we come back, we're gonna talk about two more bigger news stories, despite how big these other ones may have been. We'll be back in a quick second. I know we talked about this 2 weeks ago, or I went off about it 2 weeks ago, about this whole Bobby Drake being gay. So for those of you who maybe listen to this show regularly, if you don't listen to the stuff after the credits, maybe you won't get this so much. But we usually do an extra little segment or two or something like small at the end of an episode. And it's not to say that we wanted to downplay this, but it was kind of like it was something that we recorded before the show, and we decided to use it. Is basically me talking about me being a big X-Men fan, talking about this major, huge reveal that everyone on the internet apparently freaked out about and screamed and yelled and, you know, wanted to kill Bendis over. But this whole reveal that Bobby Drake is, or at least young Bobby Drake from the past, is gay. And it was revealed in all new X-Men, and everyone freaked out. And I think the problem was that it was revealed online. It was leaked online before it actually happened, which caused this huge outcry. And then when you actually got some context from reading the episode or reading the issue, you kind of understood what was happening. And I think my stance that I had on it, I still stand by. Like, I feel like what I talked about last time was, I'm not upset over the fact that, like, they announced that he was gay, or that it was actually, like, in the issue that, oh, Bobby Drake is gay. But I think I was, I don't know, it just seemed kind of out of place, I guess. And like I said, I probably need to go back and reread 40 issues of All New X-Men just to maybe see, like, maybe there were subtle hints, maybe there are things that I missed. But I read...
That sounds like a rational response.
Yeah, and so I'm not jumping to the conclusion of, like, this is fucking bullshit and Bobby Drake should never be gay, because that's, you know, that's wrong of me. I wouldn't want to feel... I don't feel that way, and so I wouldn't want anyone else to think that's how I was coming at it. But what I wanted to talk about, though, is the fact that I read this interview with Brian Michael Bendis on Comic Book Resources, where Bendis, he clarified the whole thing in an interview, and he's in this interview, and he said how it seemed out of place because it felt unnatural, strictly because, like, when you see, I guess, when a person, like, outs themselves or comes out to another person, a lot of the times it's not, like, natural. It's not like in this done in this grand gesture of perfection where everything is set up and built perfectly by the person who wants to tell someone else. Like, a lot of the times, and this is him saying this is not me, he says, right, you know, like, when you come out to somebody, like, maybe you do it at, like, the worst place, like, they're in the middle of eating a sandwich and then all of a sudden they choke and it's awful because they were like, oh, I had no idea, or they're so excited for you they choke on their sandwich or something, you know. Things are always a little weird. They're going to feel out of place. They're going to be unnatural. And that was conveyed in the comic. Like, the two or three pages that you actually read about this, or when this happens, is Jean takes Bobby aside and she goes away from the rest of the group and she talks to him. And it's not like something, it's not like she was standing in front of this group and she was like, oh, Bobby, why are you gay, in front of all of his friends? Like, she wasn't being accusatory. She wasn't being rude to him. She was just saying, you know, I know that you're gay. It's okay, man. Like, you don't have to hide this from me anymore. And as upset as Bobby was about it, if you read the entire scene in context, and you go into that with a mindset of, like, Jean's doing this in, like, a naive way. Like, she invaded his privacy in order to tell him this, or say that she knew this. And it felt really weird. And this the end of the scene is them walking together saying, okay, I'm glad that we were able to talk about this. And it is a happier moment. From a story-wide standpoint, to me, it feels a little out of place. But the scene itself, I think, was handled well. And I talked about, you know, this is such a big social issue. Like, so it becomes kind of a weird topic to talk about because of the social implications of it. But, like, at the end of the day, like, this is no different than, or to me, this is no different than if someone was like, well, suddenly, you know, we're just going to rewrite continuity because of whatever reason. Like, we're going to make Wanda and Pietro Maximoff no longer Magneto's children. Like, I mean, that's a thing that's happening, I think. But to me, it seems out of place. It's like you're just going to retcon 40 years worth of, like, story just because you want to, like, change something out of the blue. And maybe, like I said, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I misjudged and need to go back and reread. But to me, it feels out of place still. But Bendis is clarifying the awkwardness of the situation, kind of put some of my concern at ease, I guess. Like, when I actually read it and I understood his motivation for it, I guess it didn't feel as out of place when you actually think about it in context of everything. So I just wanted to, you know, say that or whatever. We can move on and actually talk about other stuff, but that really struck me this week is all. And it was this past week I read it and I thought it was very interesting to see where he was coming from and how he said, like, he tried to base this in as much reality as he could. You know, obviously we're talking about mutants, we're talking about people with superpowers, but at the end of the day there was a very human experience that happened, and it wasn't dressed up in drama, it was dressed in reality, like based in reality. So yeah, so I don't know. Wow. Nick, did you end up reading this issue or did you read anything else about this? I don't have to keep speaking forever.
Oh, I mean, I don't want to ruin your The More You Know segment that we're doing here, but no, I didn't read any more. It's an interesting justification on Bendis's part. Bendis doesn't strike me as the guy who would sort of backpedal or sort of manufacture a justification after the fact. He's pretty genuine, so I'm inclined to believe him. And I do think it's interesting that he is taking the approach of, yeah, it's not like on movies or you know, TV where you feel like everything leads up to some sort of revelation like that and it plays out perfectly and, you know, cue the music and everybody understands and maybe there's some crying. Yeah, it could, you know, well play out in a scenario where things are less than ideal or maybe it's just things aren't made, you know, a big deal of. It's like, you know, oh, so-and-so is like, well, you know, I'm gay, and the other person's like, okay, and that's it, and right. There isn't any sort of massive amount of fanfare or you know, anything like that is made of it. And so I think that's interesting. And I like the idea. I think the problem is that comic book readers are very much like, this character does this, and this character does this, and this character acts like this, and this character would never do this. Right. And everything story-wise has to add up. And I don't want to, obviously, stereotype all comic book readers, but there are those who are very much things that come out of left field just don't, yeah. Don't appeal to them.
Yeah, I mean, and it's another one of the cases, I think, of something like drastically changing in a comic book to incite a larger change in the story, like happening suddenly, and people just don't know how to deal with it because they're like, "This is so out of left field. It's so bizarre. Blah blah blah. It's going to ruin the comic book." And I don't think that it's going to ruin the comic book. I think it's going to be another one of those things that becomes a drastic change that has much larger implications and is good, because without comic books, without change, there is no fun in comic books. You know, there's no, you know, change could be a villain killing somebody. Change could be a villain, you know, being killed. You know, those types of things need to happen in order to incite, like, new, cool, interesting stories. And I think this is one of those times where that's happening. Alright, kick back, relax, and grab yourself a beverage. A hop if you wanna just bounce to my leverage. The evidence, as they say, is in the pudding. So show me the money like my name is Cuba Gooding. It ain't fool's gold, it's gold, fool. Can't stop, won't stop, keeping it old school. So cool. So this past week, CBS, who was producing the new Supergirl series, released a 6.5, almost 7 minute long first look at Supergirl, which gave us kind of a brief overview. Nick, do you want to talk about that, since I just blathered on for 10 minutes?
Yeah, sure. It was it was pretty in-depth. You got a glimpse of a decent amount of the show and the characters they were involving and the general setup. And, of course, I was super interested because anytime I hear that somebody like CBS is going to do a superhero show, I wonder how in the world they're going to make it, you know, fit for mass consumption, where it's not too weird and there's not too many sci-fi terms and there aren't too many weird names or aliens or technology or science or any of the other things that alert most people over the age of 65.
When are they going to do the Big Bang Theory crossover where, you know, Sheldon just says Bazinga and he's the villain for the entire episode?
Oh, man. Oh,
that's what,
geez,
I'm waiting for.
Well, wait no further. I'm sure they'll probably take that idea to heart. I guarantee you within the first season, she'll probably make an appearance or something.
Yeah.
So,
anyways.
Bazinga indeed. it's super interesting, no pun intended. It's super interesting to see CBS trying to make this as absolutely approachable as possible. And, of course, having a Supergirl without a Superman is also very interesting. They do try to deal with that. They do mention that she's got a cousin, and she's like, well, why, you know, why didn't he tell me about, you know, him doing this or whatever? And, you know, it turns into that whole, like, he wanted you to choose your path for yourself sort of thing. And it's like, okay, that's great.
Well, Nick, maybe could you give us a little bit of background on Supergirl? I mean, like, I only know,
sure,
bits and pieces.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think it's Kara Zor-El. Jordan's going to just smack me upside the head for getting this wrong. Supergirl's cousin. She leaves Krypton after Superman does, and shows up on Earth, just like Superman does, and possesses the same sort of powers that Superman does when he's not on Krypton.
This yellow sun shines on her skin. She can also fly and blow cold air and shoot lasers out of her eyes and stuff.
Laser eyes, heat vision, yep. X-ray vision, yep. All of the powers, just name them. And so we're given a glimpse of a show that sort of, in a way, has a bit of a CW feel to it. It feels like it's going to be, there's going to be, like, drama and romance, and it's going to be someone shows her juggling a job as, I think, a personal assistant,
yeah,
maybe?
Yeah, like a fashion company.
Yeah, and she's working for Callista Flockhart's character,
yeah,
which is kind of interesting to see her again.
Yeah.
And so we see her sort of juggling that job and maybe not finding it to be making her the most happy. And so she, you know, she's like, I know I can do all these things, you know, why don't I give it a try or whatnot? And so, of course, she starts fighting crime, I guess, and beginning to rapidly tell people that she's Supergirl.
Well,
so.
They kind of implied that, like, well, I should say they didn't imply, they straight up told us, like, that she's known she's had these powers for a long time, but she just didn't know what to do with them. Unlike, right. You know, it kind of reminds me of, like, an early CW Smallville where Clark Kent is kind of like, oh, I got all these powers. What am I supposed to do with them? I can't control them.
Yeah, school is tough, yeah, man. Like,
you know, and that show, you know, as campy and corny as it was, like, it was still, like, it was in a show that, like, actually tried to do Superman and did it, I mean, okay, I guess, you know. But this show seems to be a little bit more advanced in that respect, if that's the right word. Like, they like,
no, totally,
the producers or the creators of the show know that, like, you don't have to pander to people when it comes to superheroes anymore. So at least from the first look that we got, they aren't going to baby the viewer. Like, they're going to say, yeah, superheroes, you know, because, like, they're pretty commonplace. So they're not going to try to say, you know, probably, hopefully they won't spend too much time on her, like, discovering her powers and figuring things out. And it's going to be more about the juggling aspect and trying to be a superhero but try to be a regular person. You know, that classic story of, like, what Superman and all these other superheroes with secret identities are constantly trying to deal with, you know, rather than just straight up being the Arrow all day, you know? Like, Barry Allen, I feel like, as the Flash, I think he, like, that show is great because they do manage to make him juggling being a forensic investigator and the Flash really, really well. And obviously some episodes are more geared towards one or the other, but, like, the CW at least has figured that shit out. So I hope that CBS is taking a page out of that book with this series. And from the first look, it feels like they are. But I haven't seen, I don't know, supposedly there's a second trailer out there that I haven't seen that is really underwhelming compared to this first look. I know that, like, the first look sold the shit out of me. Like, I'm on board to at least watch the first handful of episodes of this show. But I saw people on Twitter saying that, you know, there was another trailer that came out that was just abysmal. Did you see anything like that?
I don't think I saw that trailer. I'm sort of surprised that there would be such a change in reaction, because really I you're right. I think that they've set themselves up for not really having to baby the viewers. I think most people are going to be like, well, I know who Superman is, so I must be pretty familiar with what she'll be capable of, which, for better or for worse, yeah, they're right. I mean, don't even get me started on the whole issue of female characters being created to just be in, you know, an analog, or, you know, the gender swapped different version of the male character,
right.
But which, you know, obviously I've got issues with and whatnot. But yeah, it makes it super approachable. Everyone's like, well, of course she can do that. Superman could do that, and of course, you know, she can fly and she can do all these things. And and instead of working for a newspaper and you know, going into a phone booth and whatnot, she works at a fashion company. So it's got a little bit of that whole Devil Wears Prada thing going on or whatnot.
Yeah.
So,
oh, yeah. I guess I didn't even think of that. But yeah, absolutely.
So yeah, I think it's going to do fine. I don't hesitate to say that. It's a CBS program. CBS does not cancel shows. It just does not happen.
Right.
You can credit them for that all you want. I mean, most of the time when cancellations run around, they might cancel one show or two. So if anything else, it's nice to know that regardless of how good or how bad this is, it's going to be given a try, and it's going to be given a chance.
Yeah.
And I'm sure they've market tested the hell out of this.
Yeah.
So
I feel like CBS usually plays things very smartly in that regard. Like, they don't release a show
smart like a supervillain smart. Yes.
Well, like they wouldn't release a show they know they're not necessarily taking a chance. Like, they're playing a safe bet, I think, with this show, in the sense that there needs to be a primetime television show about superheroes. There really isn't one. I mean, CW counts in terms of like in television, but I think that's more of a network show. And
you're talking about a main broadcasting channel.
Exactly.
NBC, CBS, etc.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I mean, ABC has been doing really well with Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. and this what's it called? Agent Carter.
Agent Carter, and Fox has Gotham.
Yeah, even then, I think there's no superhero in that. There's no superheroes in, I mean, Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. has some superheroic stuff, but there's no iconic superhero name. And I think CBS might be the first station to actually do it and do it well.
Oh, totally.
Like I said, I think that they're definitely playing on a safe bet here. So it's going to be exciting. I mean, like, I really want this to do well, mostly because I'm really curious about Supergirl. I've never read anything with her in it, and I only know of her through, like, other comic books. I think she was in the JSA for a while when I was reading that, when Geoff Johns was writing that. Or no, maybe she wasn't. Nope, I don't. Never. I'm thinking of another. I'm thinking of Star Spangled Girl, I think is her name.
Star Girl. I think you're thinking of Star Girl.
Yeah. She's
Girl.
Got like
that's Geoff Johns' creation.
Yeah. So maybe I'm wrong. But so at the end of the day, I don't know anything about this character, but I am super excited for this show. Like that's awesome. Like they sold me on this, and I think I'm sold more on this than I was when Gotham was announced or when Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. was announced. And so this is going to be really cool. Like I really hope CBS does it and does it really well, because even if it doesn't tie into Flash and Arrow, like I don't care. At the end of the day, if they're doing a superhero show right, that's all that I want. As a superhero fan, as a person who wants to watch these types of shows, this is all I want, is a well-done superhero show that like can cater to, like, my mom will watch this show with me and we will both enjoy it, maybe for different reasons, but like I could watch this show with her and both go, oh my gosh, wasn't that cool, she flew and punched that guy in the face, and you know, we'll both like get a laugh out of that or something. It's gonna be cool. Up, up, and away we go. Up, up, and it's making me glow. Up, up, and away we go. Up, up, and like it. Up, up, and away. The Archie, I want to talk about the Archie Kickstarter thing. It's such a weird topic, mostly because I can't believe how like bent out of shape people got about this. But nonetheless, so in case you're not in the know or you weren't following this, Archie the publishing company started a Kickstarter last week. Basically, their point was, with the new release of Archie number one, which is going to be written by Mark Waid and drawn by Fiona Staples, you know, Mark Waid, who's done a million billion things, and Fiona Staples has done Saga. They were, you know, they're right. I don't mean to say it like to downplay. I mean, that's all that I've seen.
Right.
You know, major work that I've seen her do. They were going to, you know, they're writing and creating the new Archie number one through Archie Press, which is awesome. Like, I'm never bought an Archie comic in my life that wasn't Afterlife with Archie. I'm going to be buying Archie number one because this is cool. Archie launched a Kickstarter that said, hey, we want to also launch some like companion titles, or not companion titles, but other new takes on, and like fresh takes on other characters in the Archie universe. So they wanted to launch Jughead number one, Betty and Veronica number one, and Life with Kevin number one, all in parallel or close to parallel to Archie number one. But I think because either they didn't have the funding or they just wanted to do it quicker based on the funding that, like, I guess they obviously didn't have the funding. They wanted people to help pay for this in advance by using Kickstarter. And maybe they were trying to gauge response. Maybe they're really hurting because of some lawsuits they've been hit with in the last couple of years. But they did this. They launched the Kickstarter. I think it got to like $14,000 or $15,000 before they canceled it.
No, it got to $35,000.
Oh, okay. Then, yeah, I guess
they reached $35,000 of the $350,000. Yeah.
Yeah, so they wanted $350,000. They got to $35,000 in about 3 or 4 days, and then they canceled it. And I think the reason they canceled it, there was a message that anyone who backed it got. I was a backer. I was really excited for it. I thought it was really cool. The message was essentially, I think, because of public outcry and because of worry that they were angering retailers and stuff, they decided to cancel it. They didn't think it was in the best interest for a publisher of such notoriety, I guess, to be doing a Kickstarter. And this kind of like brings up a lot of questions about, like, you know, Zach Braff doing a thing or whatever. But it was kind of out of nowhere that they did this. Like, I didn't hear of any in my comic book world. I hadn't heard of anything of them hurting. So yeah, it was just like out of the blue that they started this Kickstarter, but it seemed exciting. Nick, I don't know, what did you think about all this?
Yeah, I mean, there wasn't anything I read or anything that I'd come across that would have given me the impression that Archie Comics was in any sort of situation where they would require Kickstarter. Now, I realize that that's sort of a stereotype, that like Kickstarter is only for people that are starving artists or whatever or whatnot, and I disagree with that, but I also, there's obviously a certain amount of apprehension that comes when someone like Archie Comics, or as you mentioned, Zach Braff, shows up and says, yo, I need your money. And yeah, if you would have asked me how do you think Archie Comics has been doing lately, I would have said, I think they're doing great. I think this Archie reboot is on the horizon. Afterlife with Archie is doing really, 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 really well. And then, of course, you know, Sabrina's doing fantastic, and they're trying all these other fun things like Archie versus the Predator and Archie versus Sharknado. yeah. I would have never, ever gotten the idea that maybe this was a publisher that was hurting, and maybe they're not hurting. I mean, that's probably one of the other questions to be asked is, even if they're not in some sort of financial situation, what's the deal with coming to Kickstarter? And I think at that point, they basically said, we just want these books out faster, and we know you do too, to which fans said, okay.
Well, I mean, they had attached a bunch of pretty notable names to books, like Chip Zdarsky was on Jughead, Adam Hughes going to be writing and drawing Betty and Veronica. And like, I don't know, like, I feel like they pulled out some pretty big names to try to make this happen, and yet at the same time, I think the backlash was obviously too much for them. But it begs the question, like, where, if Archie can't do this, you know, or if Archie can't do this, if fans and retailers don't want, you know, publishers to be doing this, then, like, why, where are we drawing the line on Kickstarter comics? Like, should that never be associated with a publisher? Should it be strictly creator-owned, self-publish? Or, like, would it be, like, awful? And I only bring this up because I know of a case where this happened, but, like, is it okay for something to be Kickstarted and then later be published by a bigger publisher? Can it go both ways? Can, like, a big publisher do something and then have those characters then be Kickstarted and whatever and then republished back at the thing and or at that publisher? And I know that, like, I think God Hates Astronauts was a webcomic originally, and then the guy, you know, Ryan Brown, who writes and draws that series, he did a Kickstarter to get a trade paperbacks pushed out, and those went out, and people own them. And then Image republished all of those just recently as God Hates Astronauts Volume 1. And now Ryan Brown is writing God Hates Astronauts, continuing ongoing, you know, at Image. It's on, like, issue 9 or 10. Right. People have no problem with that because I think maybe he started at Kickstarter and now he's made it. Whereas if you go the other way, you've made it and you want to do a Kickstarter, then, like, there's a weird, like, frown from everyone.
Right.
I mean, totally. Like, I know other big creators have done Kickstarter. Like, Jimmy Palmiotti, I'm pretty sure, did a Kickstarter, like, 6 months ago. And
for, I believe it's called Abaddon.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I think Kickstarter exists in a very weird space with comic books. I mean, do you feel the same way, Nick?
Yeah, it is sort of bizarre, and it's like there isn't seemingly a consistent rule book on what's considered okay or not okay. Like Jimmy Palmiotti, who's arguably a very well-established comic book writer, he works on several very, 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 you know, big-name books like Harley Quinn and I think Harley Quinn and Power Girl, and I think he might be working on the Starfire one as well. So you've got a guy here who's a huge name, and he goes over to Kickstarter, and he's like, you know, I'm doing my own project, and I think he might have been working with Justin Gray on that as well. I'm not certain. Yeah. But nobody really bats an eye at that. Everyone's like, well, you know, we get that, you know, creator owned. I think there's a lot of competition at Image these days to get, like, creator owned stuff done. So you just sort of do it on your own. I think probably part of the problem there, and I don't want to get into this too much, and I don't know if you agree or not, but we're not seeing as many new series with Image now that a lot of their books are actually doing super well. So you're not seeing things, you're not seeing that interchange of new, you know, new stuff as much as you used to.
Well, unless you're Alice Cott.
Unless you're Alice Cott, in which case, just wait 3 months, so you'll have something new.
Yeah, yeah.
So yeah, people don't care about, like, Palmiotti and stuff like that. Or with the case of Ryan Brown, you know, people don't care if Kickstarter is where you start. And then move on, and if your stuff is great, you know, the Kickstarter people can say, you know, I knew him when, and the Image people can say, I agree, this is great. But yeah, there's some weird apprehension when Archie Comics, which is, I don't know, maybe they're like the, what would you say, like the eighth biggest publisher, maybe something around there, seventh or eighth?
Maybe. I mean, like, I actually have that Star Wars market share thing up. They aren't even on the top 10.
I was about to say, it's like, DC Marvel, probably Image Dark Horse, then you got Valiant and Boom in the mix, and so yeah, you're already a couple down.
Yeah.
But even that being said, even if you're that far down on the list, if you are a formal publisher with a recognizable character and a recognizable group of characters, and you've had past success, if you go over to Kickstarter, everybody freaking loses it. And yeah, I can kind of see why people are upset. I think right now they're doing fine. I think their reboot's going to go great. And as you pointed out before, let's not put the cart before the horse. Let's see how this Archie reboot book does before we go and spawn three more sequels.
Right. That was something that I was kind of, like a little hesitant on. Like, yeah, I mean, when I backed it for like the $20 level mark, which means that I got Archie number one, Jughead number one, and Betty and Veronica number one, and then any stretch goals, I'd probably get extra comics and stuff. Oh yeah, I'm looking at market share. Sorry, I looked something up while Nick was talking. Our market share overall sales, if we're looking at March 2015, Archie had 0.58% of all sales, with Marvel having 41%.
Slightly more than 0.5%.
Yeah, yeah. And that was 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11. So they were number 11 on the list. Either way. But yeah, so like, I mean, I was hesitant, but like at the same time, I did want to get Jughead. I did want to get Benny and Veronica. Like, I want to try all these number ones because I only know a little bit about Archie from what I've gleaned from Afterlife with Archie, which, by the way, let me just segue a little bit. If you're trying to get into Archie right now, you should read Afterlife with Archie, straight up. That will give you, like, you as a person probably, I don't know, I'm going to make a sweeping generalization, just assume you understand what Archie is or who Archie is. But if you just read Afterlife with Archie, you don't need to know anything going into that book. You can read it just totally. With a base idea of even, you don't even really even know who Archie is, but like they give you enough background in such a natural, organic way of the series that you get everything that you need to know about everything. And so if you're going to start with Archie, pick up that trade, go buy. I highly suggest it. Not only is it a fantastic book with probably some of the greatest art you can find in comic books right now, but it also like gets you into the Archie universe and gets you curious to know more about these characters. Which is why I wanted to jump on this Archie bandwagon and get all these number ones, because I've gotten little hints and pieces, but now I want to know more, you know? So I was all for it, but at the same time, it's like, what if Archie number one isn't that good? Like, and that's kind of assuming a lot. Like, I don't think Mark Waid's going to like fuck this up, but like, what if it's not the story that people want? What if it just doesn't do that well? So it'd be really interesting to see how that all plays out, and then to find out that Jughead and Betty and Veronica are like in the same vein and just not very good for some reason. Like, I think that's a very, very unlikely situation. Like with the names and people that they were going to be throwing on these books, I don't think that any of them are. It would be surprised if they all failed. Like, maybe one won't do well, but I think, like, out of those, the four that they announced, I think that two or three are probably going to sell okay, at least for the first arc. But yeah, maybe they were getting ahead of themselves. Maybe that, I don't know. I guess we won't know, because that Kickstarter's over.
That Kickstarter is over, so now we're just gonna have to wait and see how Archie number one does, and if what they said is true. We should end up seeing those three other books eventually anyway. If I recall what they said they're still on the docket. They just wanted to speed things up, so to speak.
Yeah.
So
be interesting, but. Yeah, I don't know.
let that be a lesson to DC if you're considering going to Kickstarter for help with anything. Just don't.
Yeah.
Thank you for listening to the I Read Comic Books podcast, a production of Destroy the Cyborg, produced by Mike Rappin, and produced and edited by Xander Riggs. This week's music was brought to you by Madcon, Can't Stop, Won't Stop, and Infinity Shred. If you'd like to keep up with the I Read Comic Books podcast, you can subscribe to it on iTunes and Stitcher. And while you're there, take a quick moment to rate us. If you have any questions or would like us to talk about something on the podcast, you can email the show at cyborg@destroythecyb.org. You can also follow us on Twitter @destroythecyb and on Tumblr @destroythecyborg.tumblr.com. And again, thank you for listening. Thank you.
what else we got? The Thor reveal, Thor number 8. We now know who Thor is, and it's Jane Foster, a.k.a. Natalie Portman, a.k.a. merely a picture in Avengers 1 and merely mentioned in Avengers 2. That's how important she was to them. But I don't know. I think it's interesting. I've talked to a couple people that are actually kind of mad. Like, Jordan was not happy with this. He's like, everyone's talking about it now. Like, oh, thank goodness, Thor's been revealed, and now we can go back to getting normal Thor now, and, you know, this little stunt is over, you know?
Yeah, I think that diminishes the point of what Marvel was trying to do, though. Like, that mentality, I think, I don't know. I think her, I don't know, her being Thor seems like, oh shit, why didn't I think of that? In the same way that when it was realized, when we realized that Thunderbolt Ross or Jay, whatever the fuck his name is, the general in Hulk, ended up being Red Hulk. Like, I should have, in my head, I was like, oh shit, that's like the only person that I could have thought, didn't think of, you know, because, you know, since Marvel didn't talk about them, Marvel does a good job of hiding all of their shit. I have a lot of strong opinions about this, Nick. You're going to make me real salty this week if we're going to talk about this.
No, I mean, I think we're on the same page here. Like, for me, like, or at least, especially with what Jordan was saying, he felt like this reveal was sort of unnecessary. I think partially he's worried that this reveal means that it's going to sort of send a signal to people that don't worry, this is the first step to getting you your old Hulk back, your old Thor back. Like, Jordan doesn't want that, and he wants this Thor. And he feels that this is sort of like the first step to not having her as Thor anymore. And that it, like, sort of this novelty reveal takes away from, like, what she's done as Thor, because now it's way more about who she is than what she's done.
Yeah, I think they could have teased it for a little while longer. The same, I mean, I think Marvel is trying to do what Heroes did, you know, where, like, season one, okay, cool, we're not gonna fucking have any story going on until the very last two episodes. And then season two was all story all the time, to the point where it was confusing, you know? And so when you think about, like, the Red Hulk, Marvel sat on Red Hulk for, like, a year or two. Like, it was, or maybe that's how long it felt in my head, if it wasn't a year or two. And then they revealed, and everyone was like, oh, well, shit. Because I guess we fucking sought out every single person in the goddamn universe except him. So maybe it was obvious to some people. I didn't care too much. I was kind of just annoyed by it, because it was like, hey, we've got a problem. Let's just throw Red Hulk at it, because he's fucking anarchy. And that's not like Avengers doing that. That was just like, Marvel's like, hey, we got a problem. We need to have a, you know, an antagonist show up. Let's just throw Red Hulk at it every single time. It became really annoying, at least in my opinion. So, okay. But that's not necessarily the same thing as this whole deal with Thor. Whereas with her being Thor, kind of just it detracts. I don't know, the fact that she has cancer and that she is dying and she's no longer going to be Thor kind of makes this whole big change of her, of like a female Thor, Lady Thor, you know, like, or the new Thor is probably the way that we should present it, is the new Thor.
Like new Coke.
Well, kind of. I mean, I don't know. I think the most respectful
thing is to just say Thor, but I understand what you're getting at. Yeah.
Yeah. Where you could say an old Thor versus new Thor, and I think that's the best way to say it, because as soon as we go Lady Thor or female Thor, then we're being.
Oh, like, unfortunately, to some people, we're being pejorative. Yeah.
Yeah. And so, so like her being Thor kind of just, and dying means that like all of this crazy shit that Marvel's like, Thor's never going to be the same, is for naught. It's another example of how every time they say, oh, something big is going to happen, it's going to be a major change forever. Forever means 6 to 8 months.
Right. Right.
And I don't know. Like, we can have side-by-side Thors. We know that we can have side-by-side Thors. We can have side-by-side Thors that are basically using two different hammers, but they're essentially both Thor. Look at Beta Ray Bill. Look at Beta Ray Bill and Thor. Like, those two can coexist. So I don't know what the point is here. Like, maybe her cancer's going to be cured. Like, that's something that I really wish Marvel would just do once and for all and say, okay, you got cancer? No, you don't, because fucking old father said nay.
Isn't one of the more sinister aspects here anyway that apparently her wielding the hammer is actually either causing or worsening her condition? I thought someone told me that.
Yeah, I think that is it. That is true. It's worse than her condition. Like the more she uses the Thor idol, like the weaker she becomes.
Right. So I think he got something.
Which makes
there.
Me wonder, like, is she truly worthy of the fucking hammer? Uh-oh. Then at that point, uh-oh. You know?
Yeah.
And that's just a general like comic book question, because if you need to be worthy, like, it shouldn't fucking kill you, right?
Right. Yeah.